My name is Farisha Rahman and I work with the Deakin Alumni Relations Office here in Burwood, Melbourne. Thanks to everyone who's joined us today. We're really excited to have Deb present for us. Amongst her many achievements, she was named Australia's Most Innovative Academic in 2013. So I'll pass over to you now, Deb.
Thanks, Farisha. Welcome everyone. Thanks for coming along today to listen to me talk. I thought I'd start by actually talking a little bit about myself. And who I am. So the question is really, and I'm often asked, what kind of academic am I? I'm an academic, but I'm also an innovator, and it's an unusual combination. In fact, in 2013, I was named Australia's Most Innovative Academic, which is a kind of weird thing to have someone tell you that you are. But it's an interesting time, I guess, and in fact, if we take the Prime Minister's words, there's never been a more exciting time in Australia than now to be an innovator. We're in the middle of apparently an ideas boom. This is a knowledge economy. It's all happening in innovation. But what does that actually mean to be an innovative academic? And I think most of my colleagues would think that they are pretty innovative themselves and that they do lots of really great work. And I don't disagree with them. I think universities do amazing things. Wonderful things happen inside universities. The critical problem is the public doesn't very often hear about it. And so to some extent, the projects I'm going to talk to you about today were designed to address that problem. How do we let the public know, and not just know, participate in the great things that happen inside universities, the really amazing research that we do, the wonderful ideas that get generated? How do we engage the public and involve the public? So it's not just about publicity, this is about getting the public to actively get in there and work with academics in a productive and positive way. This is pretty unusual, and I think this is how I got the innovation tag, because typically universities have made their business from being what we would call exceptional, in the sense that they've raised themselves out of and away from the societies that support them. They usually sell themselves as being a kind of an elite, an intellectual elite and a social elite. They're very hard to get into. The academics who work in them are usually isolated from the world and often even from each other. So we have these things called disciplines, which separate us, faculties, administrative units that are designed to keep academics away from each other rather than working collaboratively. So a way of thinking about universities in that sense is to think of them as silos. And they are silos within silos. But if we know anything about innovation, we know one thing. And the evidence overwhelmingly tells us that if we want to produce innovation, then we need to encourage social and intellectual diversity. We actually need to bump people up against each other who wouldn't normally get to sit next to each other or speak to each other. If you want to build innovative teams or organisations, you need diversity. Diversity enhances creativity. Innovation comes from letting all those dissimilar people and ideas mingle. And that's, again, getting back to this point, what we're not doing very effectively as universities. We're not engaging with the publics outside us, and we're not encouraging that engagement inside. How do we break down those silos? And that's what the crowdfunding project that I've been working on for the last few years at Deakin University has been designed to do. So if we have a look at this idea of universities exist for a social or public good, this is how we normally or typically understand universities, then we can also think about the flip side of that, which is universities benefit from the social. The social is good for universities in the same way that universities exist to produce social good. So crowdfunding is a way of encouraging this idea of how we can use a better set of social relationships between the university and the public to produce greater good. For both the public and for universities as well, to make them more innovative and in a sense to capture that potential, creative potential that you get from breaking down walls and getting people to work collaboratively. So just before I really get stuck into this, I want to kind of clarify some language. People often get confused between crowdsourcing, which is when you have a large number of people address an undertaking via micro-tasking. And a good example of crowdsourcing, my favourite example, is an Australian example, and it's considered one of the kind of benchmark examples in the world. The National Library of Australia digitised all its newspapers, but the OCR technology that they used to digitise it wasn't very accurate. It had a lot of mistakes in it. Too many mistakes for the library themselves to correct. So what they did is they opened it up to the public, and the public can go in, you can do this, you search on an article, if you can't really read the article but you kind of know what it's saying, you're allowed to go in and correct it directly using their online platform, and then you just submit the corrections, and that then becomes a benefit to everyone else who wants to read that article later. So that's a great example of crowdsourcing. But in the example I've given you, the crowd in this instance doesn't really have any creative involvement with the library. They're just going in and performing a task that, in a sense, benefits the library because the library can't afford to do that task, but it's not like you're creating something innovative or new other than this much larger thing, which is a corpus of digital newspapers. Crowdfunding is where you actually distribute finance, so a large number of people can address a problem by funding it. And again, this might seem like a very passive thing to do in some ways. You know, the crowd is essentially just providing money for someone else's creativity or for someone else's project. But in the case of the crowdfunding that we've been doing in the university system, it's actually a lot more interesting and beneficial than you might imagine. And I want to explain some of the benefits of crowdfunding as we go through this webinar. But first I'm going to show you some examples of lots of different projects which you may not be aware of that have been crowdfunded. So here you'll see the Statue of Liberty, which is a very early example of crowdfunding. So crowdfunding's been around a long time. In fact, you know, you could argue that it's been around since the Middle Ages in some ways. But this is a very public example. The Statue of Liberty was built, it was already built, but it hadn't been put up on the plinth. And a New York-based newspaper opened public donations up to construct the plinth for the Statue of Liberty. And people would send in, you know, coins taped on the back of envelopes and stuff like this in order to get the Statue of Liberty erected in the harbour outside New York. So that's a classic example of crowdfunding. The Sydney Opera House is another good example. That was in large part built through public subscription, through lottery funding. We've got that interesting looking potato salad. I put that in there as a kind of light-hearted example of some of the silly things that get crowdfunded. So for example, there was a guy called Zach Danger Brown who wanted to try his hand at making a potato salad, but he'd never made one before and he was nervous about wasting money on ingredients. So he jumped onto Kickstarter in order to raise the $10 that it was going to cost to make the potato salad, and he ended up with $55,000. So that's a $55,000 potato salad. The thing about that is you can only ever do that once. Right, no one's ever going to fund a second potato salad. The Beehive is a great example of an Australian crowdfunding project that absolutely succeeded online. This was an Indiegogo project to allow honey to be harvested without disturbing bees. And you know, a lot of people now are very interested in domestic beehives and things like that. So it was just all really good timing. People who contributed to the project ended up with a version of the beehive if they contributed enough money. So it was kind of a way of prototyping the design and getting it into production in a really great way. What else have we got there? We've got the Pebble Watch, which is one of, again, the more successful crowdfunding projects. The photo of the skyscraper in the middle is a skyscraper in the centre of Bogota in Colombia, which is probably the most, I think, still the most sort of the highest crowdfunding raise ever in the history of crowdfunding. So the people in that city who really wanted a skyscraper downtown publicly subscribed to an equity fund to build that skyscraper, and it was worth, you know, tens of millions of dollars. So that's a really interesting example of very large scale crowdfunding. And the one in the top right hand corner, which is sort of a bit weird, it's a glass dish with some weird looking things in it. They're actually maggots. And that's a wonderful crowdfunding project that we did here at Deakin. So this is an example of research crowdfunding, funding researchers to do a project that otherwise wouldn't have been able to attract any funding. And in this instance, it was about using maggots to treat an ulcerous skin condition known as the Bairnsdale ulcer. It only affects a very small amount of the population in Australia, so it's not something that was in the government's sights as a big problem that needed to be resolved and given lots of funding. But for the people in that particular region that are affected by that disease, this is a terrible thing and it really has a big impact on the local community. So the idea was to put this out to crowdfunding to see if the local community was interested enough to get some research underway to have a look at what could be done in terms of treating that problem and then possibly even later preventing it. So we think that it's our belief that that was the first ever medical clinical trial crowdfunded. And that's sort of, it was one of our very earliest projects at Deakin in terms of crowdfunding researchers. And it became for us a real motivation because it was so successful to keep going with this idea. So that's the reason I kind of put that photo up there. So in terms of the size of crowdfunding is a massive market and it's continuing to grow. The growth has tailed off a little bit over the last couple of years. These are statistics I'm showing you are now about 2 years old or a year old. Asia is now the biggest growth area for crowdfunding, but that's partly, I think, because they've come to the crowdfunding market slightly later. So those figures look huge because they're growth figures. But you'll see that around the world, the billion-dollar value of crowdfunding is quite significant and it is simply growing. So this is a really, really interesting area for people to engage in. Right across the globe. This is not something that's just specific to Australia or even the English language world that we might be more familiar with. There are different models for crowdfunding. The donation model, which is the one you're probably most familiar with, those of you that have already given some money to a crowdfunding project. Donation model is usually either purely altruistic, like you just give money and you don't expect anything back, or it can be what's called reward-based. So you might have an incentive or a reward, and we talked a little bit, for example, about the beehive, where you got a beehive if you invested enough money once it went into production. So that's an interesting and most common model for crowdfunding. There's also investment models which are equity-based, so you might get a share in whatever results from the crowdfunding. They can be lending-based, so peer-to-peer lending is a interesting and big area crowdfunding, but you're normally expected to pay the money back, but at a much lower interest rate than you would if you were dealing with formal financing models. And they can be royalty based, so you can go in on the basis that you'll receive royalties from whatever it is that you're investing in. That whole area is subject still to a lot of legislative debate. So in Australia, for example, we've had legislation presented around equity-based investment. That's now been taken off the table because we're having an election. So the crowdfunding community in Australia thought would be a really amazing year this year in terms of the development of these new models now has to take a bit of a backseat, and we're looking probably at next year before anything will really happen in relation to equity-based investment. But you can do this in other countries around the world. Colombia was one that I mentioned. The US has some equity-based legislation now. The UK and New Zealand are very big on equity-based crowdfunding. There are also different techniques for crowdfunding. All or nothing is the one that Deakin uses. This is where you collect money up to a target amount, and if you don't get the target, you don't get anything. So you have a time frame and a target, and it's hit or miss, quite literally. Keep it all means that even if you don't meet the target, you still get to keep the money that you raise. And then bounty is where you sort of put jobs out for tender, basically, and people bid for the jobs and or the solution. It might be a design job, for example. And then you only give money to the lowest bidder or the bidder who successfully provides a requested service. The company that we work with, Possible.com, prefers the all-or-nothing model, so that's the model we've worked with. And it does kind of give a really interesting momentum to a crowdfunding project because bids or pledges or donations tend to come in very early in a project and then they plateau off, and I'll show you some graphs of this in a minute. And if you've got a target with a deadline, they then tend to pick up again at the end. And if you don't have that momentum, sometimes it's really hard to convince people to give the money, especially with Keep It All, because they're just like, oh, well, they've got enough now, I'm not going to give any more money. Whereas a target-driven project does tend to produce more momentum. And the other thing is that you can be assured that whoever is raising the money has thought about how much money they need to do the project. If they don't get all the money, then it's quite possible they can't do the project anyway, but they take your money and don't do the project, which is not ideal. So all or nothing does mean that the donor or the person pledging the money is reassured that the project should go ahead because all the money's been raised. So in terms of research, which is what I'm interested in crowdfunding, there are different ways of approaching that as well. So some platforms have been set up just specifically to fund research. So the Mycorrhiza and Thinkable are two big examples. I don't think Petri dish exists anymore, so that's an example of one that, kind of flourished and then floundered. You can also have what are called university-specific platforms, which are largely for student-driven projects, internal projects within the university. And then there are some specialist education platforms, and Crowdcube or Hubbub is a good example of that. They're a UK company that simply provide crowdfunding opportunities for universities and schools. That's what they do and that's what they specialise in. What we did at Deakin is we chose to work with a company that, Possible.com, that crowdfund a wide range of projects. And we did that for all the reasons I outlined at the start of this webinar. We really wanted to get these projects out into places where they wouldn't normally be. And so by working with a company like Possible, who are an incredibly enthusiastic Melbourne-based company, so they're local to us, signed on in terms of what we were doing, really happy to adapt their systems to work with a university, and in the same way we had to adapt some university systems to work with them. But it was a really good, you know, it is and was when we started and from the outset a collaborative relationship that was, I hope, mutually beneficial for all of us. It certainly was for the university. Yeah, so they essentially adopted an all-or-nothing model based on the idea that their platform provided what we needed, which is a crowd of people not just within the university or not just attached to the university, but the public, a genuine public. So just to summarise what we've been able to achieve here at Deakin, we've got over a period of years, 23 projects launched, 19 fully funded so that they've met their targets. That's an 83% success rate. That's a pretty remarkable success rate in any business. If you applied for a research grant, you'd probably be applying, for example, for an Australian Research Council grant. Their success rates are less than 20%. If you apply for a specialist grant, say a medical grant or whatever, similarly it's 20% or less, typically. And generally you have to be an expert in your area, well recognised, with lots of publications. You're usually a professor, not always, but often, and you have to know people in the know in a way. So only a certain small number of people are even competing for that 20% success rate. One of the nice things about crowdfunding and the reason we did it is because we really wanted to support early career researchers, researchers who didn't have necessarily a professorial title, who didn't necessarily know people in the know, and so on. We wanted to give them a chance to get some runs on the board. And so what we're really interested in with crowdfunding is what I would call the long tail of research funding. People often say to me, oh, this is a really bad initiative because the government will stop giving money to researchers. That is not what we've experienced. You know, the sorts of projects we're putting up are small projects. They're usually between $5,000 and $20,000. So they're not competing with people applying for $200,000 or $2 million to do the really, really big super projects, super research projects. These are small projects attached to often early career researchers who are looking for their break. Just because they're early career doesn't mean they don't have great ideas. It doesn't mean they don't have something important to contribute, but they're often locked out of the funding systems that would normally be accessible to more senior researchers. As you see from those statistics on your screen, we've also been able to attract over 2,000 donors to give money to academic researchers. That's just engagement beyond our wildest imaginations. To have people who are absolutely prepared from the public to say, yes, I think this is a great idea, I'd like to see it happen, and to put their money down on the table is just heartening. It really makes me sing because it's the kind of thing you want to see in terms of breaking down this boundary between academic researchers and publics. This is an example of not just the public being passive, but basically saying, I want this to happen. I'm going to green light this project. And in doing that, they really do get these projects off the ground and forward and they make change. This is about letting the public have agency in what we do as academics, not what typically used to happen in universities, which is other academics deciding if your academic work is okay. This is absolutely about the public getting in behind it. So this is how we first started. We set up this project called Research My World, and it was a pilot project. We really weren't sure how this was going to work. It managed to succeed. We successfully funded 6 out of 8 projects that we put up on the site, and everyone was so happy with this that we decided we would not just continue with it as a pilot project anymore, but we would actually push this into a broader category. So we went from being a kind of what we call a collection, which is a group of similar projects within the website of Possible, into becoming a category. So what happens now is that any research institutes or any other universities can put their projects up at Possible as well. Again, a lot of people said, why did you do that? Because really, you know, if that's Deakin's initiative, why doesn't Deakin just exploit that and keep it to themselves? That would defeat the whole purpose of why we did this, which is about, again, getting different groups of people to work collaboratively and together, which is really important to us. It's also about attracting people to a category. The more people that are funding research, the more benefit to everyone, because it becomes a familiar thing to do. So you'll see now in Possible a little, I've just put a red circle around it, research. So you can fund music, you can fund film, you can fund art, and you can now fund research, which is fantastic. Okay, what makes a successful project? And this is a really good question. We've done a lot of analysis because, of course, we are academics, so we tend to go to the pointy end of things. We've tried to work out what it is about why some research projects succeed and a tiny or small number don't. And one of the things we've uncovered, of course, is that social media is absolutely critical to getting a crowdfunding project off the ground. So one of the big success factors for us overall, and what you see on your screen is the specific project success factors, but overall, one of the things I would say is most successful about this innovation is it's got a whole bunch of academics into social media. And again, that kind of plays to the point I'm trying to make about getting academics out from behind the ivory tower into the public and sharing their ideas with not just each other, but with a whole bunch of people they may or may not even know through social media. Project success factors, definitely Twitter is absolutely critical to getting a project successfully off the ground. So let's have a look at what a social network analysis visualization would look like of both a successful and a failed project. So on the left of your screen, you'll see a representation of Twitter activity in a project that didn't succeed. And on the right of your screen, you'll see a representation of Twitter activity in a project that did succeed. And what you can see is that the project that did succeed has more tweets, but it also has more retweets. And so we've done quite a lot of investigation around tweets and retweets and their relationship to donations. And I'll show you a diagram. This is a diagram that from that first pilot study that we did that shows pledges in red and tweets and retweets in blue. And as you'll see, that's a pretty closely correlated visualization of donation behavior and Twitter behavior. And we've in fact tested this because it's a reasonably small sample, so we don't want to kind of make too much of a big deal about it, but we've actually done the statistical analysis, and we can say this now with some confidence that the coefficient between tweets and dollars is in fact remarkable, and we can easily say that projects that tweet and get retweeted are more likely to be funded than ones that don't. So social media, and in particular Twitter, appears to be absolutely critical for successful crowdfunding projects, and particularly in our case where we've done the analysis, research crowdfunding or crowdfunding research projects. That's probably of no surprise to a lot of people, but it is in fact, I think, quite interesting and important to actually see the evidence of that. Not all projects necessarily work with Twitter, so Facebook can be very important too, LinkedIn, other forms of social media behaviour are kind of important. This is a visualisation of pledge behaviour between projects. So what we're looking at in this diagram is whether people are pledging only to a project that they're passionate about or whether they're following a researcher. And what we can see in this visualisation is that, in fact, yes, some of our researchers who have done more than one crowdfunding project are keeping their, you could call them fans or supporters or people who are interested in their work, and are carrying them from one project to another. That's kind of interesting to us. Now, I'll show you a different way of visualising that, which is also, you can sort of see in this visualisation of the relationship between the number of pledges across to projects and then the number of rounds that we've had. So we usually run 2 rounds a year at Deakin, and people tend to, as you'll see by the huge bubble on the left, which is, if we click on it, a purple bubble, in honour of Prince, of course. That purple bubble is very big, and that's people who give one pledge in one round. Then we have people who pledge two or more times in a round, but don't come back for any more. They're the yellow bubbles. So they're the people who are pledging multiple projects in a given round. People that pledge twice in 2 rounds or 3 times in 3 rounds and so on are in green. And then there are a very small number of people who make frequent pledges in multiple rounds. They're all the red people. So they're people that are just coming back to have a look to see what sort of research we're doing and funding lots and lots of different projects. So they're not focused on a particular problem that they think should be solved. They're funding, in general, the idea of crowdfunded research. So you see, of course, they're a much smaller number, but they're still an important factor for us. So as I mentioned, I think one of the kind of most exciting things about this project is that we've given the researchers themselves a whole bunch of skills that they're now going to take on for the rest of their career. Their use of social media, their ability to have a digital footprint where they can discover new contacts, find other people in their fields and so on. So these are just some quotations from some of our researchers and talking about, I guess, what they felt the benefits were. If you're particularly interested in the work we've been doing, we've made public all our research on our research. So you can head along to any of these URLs and look up our initial report on the pilot study. If you're interested yourself to run a research campaign using crowdfunding, we've got a checklist for you to have a look at. Check out the Possible page as well, which is really useful in terms of giving tips and tricks for doing this kind of research. And that last one, Hot Tips, is really just about social media for academic researchers and just, you know, giving some pretty clear and pragmatic advice on how often you need to tweet, how much time you need to put aside every day, that kind of stuff. So, in summary, I just want to talk about this initial kind of distinction that I made between universities existing for social good and then this idea that the social is actually also good for universities. Obviously, both things apply. And that plays very neatly into our latest project, which is a project called Seeking Refuge. Deakin University is supporting and facilitating the Barwon Community Legal Service and a number of other advocacy organisations in the Geelong area where Deakin is based to support interpreters to assist asylum seekers who are applying for visas. So the federal government is moving all asylum seekers in Australia at the moment onto a new set of visas. The application process is especially onerous. It's over 100 questions and about 80 pages. Even if you spoke English as your first language, this would be a terrible ordeal, I think. Many lawyers are providing pro bono services, which is wonderful because they work for big companies that continue to pay their salary even when they support these sorts of projects for free. But interpreters don't work for those same big companies, so they can't provide pro bono services. We have to pay for them. Every application costs about $465. So we're looking to try and fund 150 applications with interpreters. So $465 to pay for an interpreter for each of those 150 applications. We launched this project this week. It's an incredibly exciting initiative. It's an initiative I'm particularly proud of because I think it does all those things we've been talking about today. It demonstrates the social good that universities can do, but it also shows how the social, the public, can participate in making the world a better place as well. So it does both those things. And so I'd really encourage you to head along to that website and, if you can, to donate or to share it in your social media. That would be a really wonderful thing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Deb. That was a really interesting presentation. I actually learned a lot about crowdfunding. So now let's answer some of your questions. If any of you have any questions, please type it into the question box. We'll begin with a question from Prashant. Do people expect a return for their investment for crowdfunding a research project? If so, what tangible returns do they get?
The tangible returns thing is kind of interesting. Because we're a university, we're what's called a deductible gift recipient organisation. So if you make a donation to Deakin, to a Deakin researcher, you are eligible for a tax receipt. But if you get an incentive for making a donation, you may not be eligible for a tax receipt. So what we try really hard to do, because I think a lot of people are interested to donate for the purposes of making a tax deduction, is we have to come up with incentives and rewards that don't appear to be of any particular material value. So I'll give you the example of the Maggot Project, which is wonderful, right? So the Maggot Project, they wanted to give incentives. And so what they did is they dipped the maggots in paint, non-toxic paint, put them on a canvas and let them wriggle around, and then they had what they described as maggot art. And so for your donation, you could get a piece of maggot art. And you have no idea how many people donated to that project because they wanted some maggot art. It actually did look really fantastic. And then they made little videos as well, and it kind of helped spread the message about the project. So it was a kind of fun idea.
Yeah, that sounds like a nice gesture. We'll go on to the next question. Can you nominate any other good crowdfunding companies? So apart from Possible, what are the good platforms?
Yeah, so there's, if I'm looking for a platform, generally what I would be looking for is a platform that has proven track records, so they need to have been around for a little while. They need to be able to take multi-currencies, so you don't want a platform that can only work in one currency, because these are global platforms, you hope. So one of our restrictions when we were looking around at platforms was we couldn't work with, for example, a company that would only take US dollars, because that was just too limiting for us. Make sure that they have projects similar to the one you're launching and they've succeeded on that platform site. So I could name them, but I think the biggest growth area in crowdfunding is platform development. So just be very careful when you choose a platform.
Moving on to our next question, I think there is another kind of technique that someone donates to a company or an institution. Would you work with these ones?
There probably are more techniques. I really just summarised the main ones. So that's absolutely true. I think this is a very innovative area. It's very new. So I think people are creating new ideas. Like I heard the other day a really interesting idea where you donate to a project and your donation is attached to a dare, and so you dare the person running the project to do something silly, you know, like, I don't know, jump off a cliff or do a bungee jump or something like that.
Yep.
And they, in accepting your donation, they agree to the dare. So that's a kind of fun technique. So there are lots of techniques, I absolutely agree. Yes, we're always open to thoughts and ideas. And in fact, crowdfunding at Deakin will expand over the next 18 months into a whole bunch of new areas. And we're very excited about this.
Great. I've got a question about Twitter. How did you influence the Twitter feed? Was it purely by putting out regular tweets yourself, or are there other ways to influence this?
Yeah, that's a great question, because many of the researchers we worked with didn't have strong Twitter profiles when they started with us. They generally did by the end, but when they started, they often had no followers or a handful of followers, and of course it's a bit limited because if they're sending out tweets, it's not really going to a lot of people. So I gathered together all of the strongest academics and non-academics on staff at Deakin with the biggest Twitter profiles and got them mobilised. We were helped out a little bit by the Deakin social media unit itself, so of course they have a big following. But what we did is we trained the researchers in how to improve their Twitter reach by using what we call super tweets, so people who have very, very big Twitter profiles. So we would get them to research in their area, in their discipline or in their research field. Who is it that are the super tweets? You know, if you're working, for example, in the refugee project that we're doing, one of the biggest super tweets in that field is Julian Burnside, the lawyer. He has a huge Twitter following. He's really motivated by these issues. So what you do is you send out a tweet and you add his handle and ask him to retweet. We had a great success with this. Stephen Fry, the the comedian sent out a tweet for one of our researchers because the researcher was working on an environmental problem that Stephen Fry was also very interested in. When we did this, Stephen Fry's people contacted Deakin to make sure that our platforms could handle the amount of Twitter traffic that was expected to come from being retweeted by Stephen Fry, because he has, you know, bazillions of followers. I mean, he is like the super tweep of all time. So that was really, really interesting that they were quite self-conscious that simply retweeting the project might actually have an impact on the infrastructure of that project or our crowdfunding project.
Definitely, when you have that many followers.
Absolutely.
Okay, we'll go on to the next question. How has crowdfunding been used for launching research projects in environmental protection in Australia?
I'm not sure it has necessarily. I'd have to do some... I take that question on notice just because I'm not familiar with every single project that's been funded. There have been quite a lot of environmental projects. We had a really great project looking at the human consumption of local seaweeds in Australia. So if you eat seaweed, most of the seaweed that you eat in Australia is imported. And after Fukushima, that presented all sorts of interesting problems because of food security around nuclear contamination. And also it's not very sustainable to import food long distances, particularly when you've got a lot of seaweed already here on the shoreline. So what the researcher did is she funded, through crowdfunding, a taste trial. And the people who put money in from her local community, she lived in Warrnambool where Deakin have a campus, they became the taste trialers. So you not only were they putting money in, but they then got involved in the project because they got to actually be part of the experiment. It was a fantastic project, and she went from being this kind of, I think, reasonably shy, reserved scientist in a lab coat to being this extroverted, social media, you know, traditional media, on TV, talking about her project kind of person who was being mobbed in the streets by the local community because they suddenly had a sense of what Deakin was doing in Warrnambool, and they were participating in it.
Sounds like a great story, and that's another way to give back to your donors.
Yeah.
We had a question about regulations. How well regulated is crowdfunding generally? That is, not just regarding the equity-based module, do you think there should be more or less regulation?
I think at the moment it's pretty reasonably regulated. And what that means is, in large part, there are regulations for the platforms that they have to meet, which are the regulations around most philanthropic activity. Then there are obviously also financial administration regulations and so on. But mostly with crowdfunding, the onus is on the researcher themselves to maintain a good relationship to the donor base. So they are expected to communicate well with the donors, to let the donors know when the project's completed, what the results are and so on. And I'm just talking about research here. And in most cases that's been fine. Crowdfunding actually, it's one of those very interesting areas of innovation in which there's been almost no formal complaints to the regulators about the behaviour of project leaders and or platforms. It's kind of so negligible it's not worth mentioning. But obviously, you know, that will change as it becomes more of an accepted practice. We would expect to see more problems developing and possibly therefore the need for more regulation, but right now it seems to be working really well.
Okay, let's move on to the next question. What needs to be done to steward these donors, and how would you acknowledge them in terms of recognition?
That will depend from project to project, because some projects, you know, if you're writing up a report, you can make an incentive that you'll be named in the report as one of the project supporters, or on the website if there's a website attached to the project. And so on. Most donors don't necessarily want or need that, particularly when they're only putting in a small amount of money. And this kind of plays to the previous question as well. When you've invested $10 and the project doesn't necessarily produce what you thought it should, generally it's $10. You're not too concerned about it. If you're putting in $100,000, you pretty much want that project to do what it said it would. So it's partly about the level of investment that the low levels of investment, most donors are investing between $10 and $50. That means that compliance takes on a sort of different set of shades or flavours. for both the donor and for the project leader. We've found most of the project leaders have been really good about staying in communication with their communities because they've got now the digital skills to do it. They've got the Facebook page, they've got the Twitter account, they tend to want to keep people informed. And as I mentioned earlier, they even carry them from one project to the next.
Yes.
So that's a good sign.
Do you find that most of your donors are anonymous? So do they have that option when they're making...
Yeah, absolutely. So you can be anonymous. The amount you donate is never made public. If you want your name to appear on the page, it can, or you can choose anonymity.
Thank you. Let's move on to the next question. Have you surveyed the funders to understand their motivation to fund a particular research project?
That's a great question, and the answer is no, and I'd love to. That's like my dream, because that would complete the circle for me. I know a lot about their behaviour in terms of what they do because of the analysis we've been able to achieve by looking at how they're donating and what amounts. But motivation is an area we haven't been able to get into, and I'd love to find out.
Yeah. So do you have any tips for using crowdfunding for substance addiction and mental health treatments or in that particular space? Have you ever done one before?
We've done a couple in that space. And we've also done some interesting ones. For example, we had a nursing project that was set in Africa, looking at stress and post-traumatic stress disorders and things like that. I think this is a really great opportunity because I think these are issues that are of importance to the community. So I don't have specific tips for these very specific types of projects. Because what happens is as you develop the project plan for crowdfunding, you kind of work through those things yourself. So you start by saying, well, what's the key or critical research problem I'm solving? How does that problem then contribute to the community at a broader level? And then once you've sorted those things out, how am I going to communicate that? And where will I find the people that are most concerned or exercised by these two levels of problem, the specific problem and the larger community issue? And once you work those things out, then neural systems go.
I think this leads us to our next question. What is your experience for crowdfunding for research in two different countries?
Yeah, we have had some experience with that. We've found that to be totally fine. Like, obviously, you're in a sense doubling your audience, which is really good.
Yeah.
But mostly what people are funding is the researcher, and I think it's really important to remember that. So a lot of the work we do with the researchers is about making sure that they are the front of the project and that they are taking responsibility for running and driving the project. Deakin doesn't intervene a lot. We don't make slick videos, corporate videos. We don't try and make it look like it's money for Deakin, because it actually isn't. The money goes directly to the researchers. It sits in their bank account and they use it for the project. Deakin takes no fee, it doesn't intervene other than to try and support through social media and mentoring. We don't think it's a good thing to be seen to be, as an institution, the recipient of the money. This is about a relationship between the researcher and their stakeholders and the people that are really motivated by their passion. And that seems to be working really well for us.
We've got a question about the system. What is the system of collecting the funds? Does the platform collect them and then pass it on to the organisation or the project team? And does this vary for different platforms?
I can't speak on behalf of all platforms because I don't know. I can tell you definitely how it works with the Possible platform. So what happens is when you make, we call it a pledge, it's not even a donation, when you go onto the platform and go to the project and decide what amount of money you want to give, you have two options. You can pay by credit card or by PayPal. And I think Bitcoin is also an option. We don't tend to use that here at Deakin, but definitely credit card or PayPal. And so you select the amount. Let's say hypothetically you're donating $20 to my Seeking Refuge campaign. Hint, hint. So you select $20. If you want an incentive, you indicate at that point that you're looking for the maggot artwork or the sausage or whatever it is that you think you're going to get, or not, you don't have to receive anything. Then you click donate, and the money goes into what we call an escrow account, which is an account that sits in limbo. It's not in your account and it's not in Deakin's account either, or the researcher's account, or in the platform's account. It's just sitting in limbo. If the project makes its target, that money will then be drawn down and it will go to the researcher. If the project doesn't meet its target, it just goes back to your bank account. The transaction is just cancelled.
That's interesting. Okay, so we've got quite a lot of questions coming through, but I don't think we're going to have enough time to get through all of them. We'll just do one more. Deb, do you know if there are any government agencies that regulate these crowdfunding projects?
Lots of different parts of the government are associated or involved. The area of government that deals principally with small business and business and trade tends to be, and fiscal regulation, they tend to be the areas that cover this. But, you know, currency transactions, financing, security, all these things come into play. So what you tend to find is lots of different government departments, innovation as well. So a lot of this is coming out of Christopher Pine's area and things like that. So, you know, these are cross-jurisdictional areas in general.
I'd like to thank Deb again very much for this wonderful presentation. And thanks for everyone for joining in today.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in. Have a great Thursday afternoon.